From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Exhuming the truth, we look at legislation that aims to declassify U.S. government documents on human rights abuses in Guatemala and Honduras. Singapore's blood money. What does international drug trafficking have to do with the Morgan Guarantee Bank? And the Supreme Court rules that the videotaped testimony of President Clinton in the Whitewater case does not have to be released. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Expect a combative stance when former White House aide Harold Ickes is called to testify before Senate hearings today. Republicans intend to focus on allegations that Democrats and organized labor illegally coordinated their campaign forces last year. Ickes oversaw President Clinton's reelection campaign as Deputy White House Chief of Staff. He's told Senate investigators that the AFL-CIO's new leaders laid out the plans to help Democrats retake the House, and they did it in the Oval Office meeting with Clinton. Meantime, Ickes concedes there may have been some mistakes made in judgment over fundraising activities, but he says the White House still operated within the bounds of the law. Among other subjects, Republican senators say they'll press Ickes' involvement in the roundabout process by which some Clinton-Gore contributions were funneled through state party committees, a process Ickes and the White House stoutly defend as legal. In addition, Ickes is certain to be closely questioned about whether he sought the shredding of an embarrassing memorandum on how to route donations through tax-exempt, supposedly nonpartisan organizations. Charging that the investigation of campaign fundraising is being obstructed, congressional Republicans want to know why the White House withheld videotapes of coffees President Clinton hosted for major Democratic donors. Republican Senator Fred Thompson, who heads the Governmental Affairs Committee that's leading the campaign finance abuse investigation, said he wants to question White House officials under oath to determine why they had falsely assured investigators in September that there were no such tapes. Videotapes of 44 coffees were turned over to Thompson's committee on Friday after White House officials said they'd belatedly discovered their existence. Some are likely to be played today when Harold Ickes is grilled by the 7 Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. The Supreme Court has refused to hear 2 campaign finance cases that might have moved the justices from the sidelines to the center of the public debate over money in politics. Opening its 1997-98 term, the court made no comment in turning down the 2 cases, as well as some 1,500 other new appeals that had accumulated over the summer recess. One campaign case was an appeal by the Federal Election Commission that raised the question of how broadly the government may regulate the content of advertising paid for by so-called independent expenditures from corporate and union treasuries. The other was a challenge to a Kentucky law that prohibits any individual from contributing a total of more than $1,500 a year to all political action committees operating within the state. And on the eve of the crucial Senate votes that could determine the fate of campaign finance legislation this year, 2 important Republican swing senators had very different days. This a piece in the New York Times today. Senator James Jeffords of Vermont spent much of the day chopping wood at his 80-acre farm in Shrewsbury, meeting with constituents in Rutland, working by telephone with senators here to break a deadlock on Maine campaign finance bill. And Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine was also trying to solve the stalemate, immersing herself in back-to-back meetings with Democrats and Republicans, including a 90-minute session with one of the bill's biggest foes, Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, the majority leader. Officials of the nation's largest for-profit hospital chain are accused of trying to cover up a wide-ranging fraud scheme involving Medicare and other federal health programs. An affidavit unsealed yesterday includes evidence the government presented to a judge last summer to get search warrants for Columbia offices throughout Florida. The federal government and at least 11 states are investigating the Nashville, Tennessee-based company for fraud. 3 Columbia executives were indicted in June by a federal grand jury in Fort Myers, Florida. An outbreak of E. coli at an Iowa high school has widened, with officials now saying nearly 20 students were sickened. Officials say the outbreak of the sometimes deadly bacteria appears to be linked to the school in Parkersburg, Iowa. The school cafeteria is being checked to see if it was the source. FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt yesterday for an armored car driver accused of taking off in a company van with up to $15 million in cash. A few hours later, authorities recovered the white van reported stolen from Loomis Fargo & Company office in Charlotte, North Carolina. There was cash inside the Ford, but the suspect was nowhere to be found. American fishermen will face tighter restrictions as the government tries to rebuild dwindling numbers of some of the nation's most popular and valuable seafood. 96 species targeted by commercial and recreational fishermen, nearly one-third of the 279 species counted in federal waters, were overfished or heading that way. This, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, in a report submitted to Congress last week. And the White House is apologizing to Congress over videotapes of President Clinton's coffees. Counsel Charles Ruff acknowledges his office should have found and turned over the tapes long ago. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Human Rights Information Act, a law that would mandate the declassification of human rights records in response to formal requests from international bodies or government institutions in Latin America and the Caribbean, will be introduced to the House tomorrow. The Senate introduced the bill a few weeks ago. Government officials in Washington have had a long and well-known penchant for secrecy, especially in the foreign policy arena. But with the end of the Cold War, human rights and free speech advocates are stepping up their pressure on official Washington to open up and share their knowledge with the rest of the world. One particular area of focus is Latin America, especially Guatemala and Honduras. Joining us now from Washington are Kate Doyle and Carlos Salinas. Kate Doyle is a foreign policy analyst for the National Security Archives, an independent research group that presses for the declassification of foreign policy documents. And Carlos Salinas is Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Kate Doyle. Kate, what exactly is this bill that's being introduced into the House tomorrow?
Amy, the Human Rights Information Act, which the Senate introduced, in fact, last week, asks that the Clinton administration declassify in an expeditious and substantial manner documents that the United States government maintains on human rights abuses, violations that have occurred in the past in Latin America and the Caribbean. The aim of the act is to open up this terrible hidden history, which we still maintain in our own archives here in the United States, and which governments all over Latin America and the Caribbean, as they struggle to open their governments up, to reform their judiciaries, to end impunity in their countries, and to end the terrible traditions of human rights violence, these governments need this information now as they make these transitions, and that's what the act aims to do.
Who's introducing it?
In the House, the introducers are the Representatives John Porter and Tom Lantos.
Republican and Democrat.
That's correct. And in the Senate, it was Senator Dodd that led the way, but there are four senators supporting it so far, and additional co-sponsors will be signing on.
That's Christopher Dodd, the Democrat from Connecticut. Carlos Salinas, what would we expect to see if these documents were made public?
We hope that what we would be able to find in these documents is detailed information about hundreds of thousands of deaths and disappearances in Guatemala, as well as close to 200 disappearances and killings in Honduras. These documents would not only tell us what they knew at the time, but also shed light on what the United States government and its agencies were doing in those two countries during these past few decades.
You know, we have heard a lot about the terrible violations of human rights, the murders and assassinations of people in Guatemala. I think what the figures are, upwards of 150,000. In Honduras, the information has only recently been coming out. Can you explain what we know so far about what happened in Honduras and what the U.S. government knew and was involved with?
One of the keys to understanding Honduras is that it was the staging ground for a lot of the U.S. administration's policies towards El Salvador, towards Nicaragua. In Central America, basically the administration of President Reagan and later President Bush used Honduras to make sure that its allies in the region were receiving enough military aid. Of course, Honduras was also the staging ground for the counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua, the Contras. So when we think about Honduras, we got to remember that it was basically an operations center for the United States government. And in that, we know that they were closely working with the Honduran army, with the Contras, and any other operations in the region that required the CIA, the Defense Department, to be involved.
Also, Amy, in the early 1980s, the CIA helped to establish, fund, and train a special military intelligence unit called Battalion 316 that was later discovered to have been responsible for hundreds of disappearances of Honduran citizens and the torture and illegal detention of thousands more. The documents, we hope, will explain not only the human rights cases that the Human Rights Commissioner in Honduras is now investigating, but specifically the early history of this battalion and the role of the CIA in setting it up.
We're talking to Kate Doyle and Carlos Salinas. Kate Doyle, a foreign policy analyst for the National Security Archives, and Carlos Salinas, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean. You mentioned earlier, Kate, that this information is needed for investigations, truth commissions, prosecutions in these countries. What is happening? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of deaths. What is happening in Guatemala? We know the case of Jennifer Harbury, whose husband, Fray Ambamaco Velasquez, who was the last Mayan comandante in Guatemala of the guerrillas, who was killed by the Guatemalan military, among them those paid on the U.S. payroll. But so far, she hasn't been able to retrieve his bones or really gain any justice in that case. What about her case and others?
Jennifer's case is just one of, as you pointed out, hundreds and thousands. Excuse me. Of cases of the disappearance, torture, and assassination of Guatemalan citizens, as well as human rights violations against American citizens. And Guatemala now, as are so many countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, indeed the world, is struggling with both this painful legacy and to move towards a more just society. Part of that struggle includes investigations into past human rights violations, an attempt to clarify what happened in the past so that Guatemala and other countries who are going through the same painful process will not repeat this terrible history. In Guatemala, just 1 month ago, a truth commission, what is called in Guatemala the Clarification Commission, has been established to examine this terrible history. The truth commission is made up of international human rights lawyers and human rights experts, many of them Guatemalan, and will spend the next year investigating in a detailed way, gathering testimony from victims and victims' families, this tragedy that took place in Guatemala over the last 30 years. Next spring, the Truth Commission will report on its findings, and we believe that the United States government has an obligation, both as a friend to the peace process in Guatemala and as the most powerful nation in the world at this moment, to supply the Truth Commission with the resources it needs to clarify the truth about the past. And that would include these documents that contains information, critical information on human rights violations.
Who's standing in the way of these releases?
There is an obstructionist attitude on the part of the national security establishment in this country, and I specifically refer to the CIA and the Pentagon, in opening its files on human rights abuses in Latin America and the Caribbean. There have been efforts, not only in Guatemala, but as you mentioned, in Honduras and other countries throughout the hemisphere, to request that the U.S. government supply it with human rights information that it gathered through the years. And while the U.S. government, specifically the Clinton administration, has responded in, I should say, an unprecedented manner in the last few years, The agency that has done the most to try to open its own files has been the State Department. And to be honest, the embassies throughout Latin America in the decades during the Cold War were not in the loop. These were not the agencies of the United States government that had the direct liaison relationships with the intelligence services, the police, the military, that perpetrated these human rights abuses. So it's now up to the Clinton administration to push its CIA and Pentagon to open these files and make them public.
Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International. In the case of Honduras, there is a crusading human rights commissioner there now who has been quite angry about the lack of information, the lack of forthcomingness of the U.S. government in terms of information about human rights abuses, not to mention what the U.S. actually did. Can you talk about him?
Sure. Dr. Valladares Lanza is the National Commissioner for the Protection of Human Rights. He was first appointed to the position through an act of the Honduran presidency back in 1993 in the Honduran legislature. In December of 1993, he published a report called The Facts Speak for Themselves, detailing close to 200 disappearances and killings of Hondurans and other nationals in Honduran territory. At that time, he put in a request to the U.S. government of information concerning human rights abuses in that country, and there began basically his road to being stonewalled, which continues today. He has refiled his request for information, and he has received assurances and reassurances from senior administration officials that he would get the information. But to this day, he has not been able to get the information he's requesting, namely information on several specific cases, including that of a U.S. priest disappeared in Honduras in 1983, and also information about this Battalion 316. You have to remember that he is an elected and appointed official of Honduras who has made these requests, and he is being stonewalled. In the case of Guatemala, we know that at some point, if they haven't done so already, the Guatemalan Commission on Clarification is also going to be putting an official request. So for the United States government to continue to stonewall this information is incredible. And also, we also can't forget that while there are events happening in Guatemala and Honduras that involve prosecutions for which disinformation could be crucial, we have to remember that there is an element what's happening here in this country. And these disinformation has a lot to speak to that, especially what has been done in the name of democracy, what has been done with U.S. taxpayer money to the citizens of Honduras, to the citizens of Guatemala. What does it say about United States foreign policy? And these are questions that are intrinsic to this bill.
Tomorrow there's going to be a news conference on the East Capitol steps. Among the people who will be there are Joe and Eileen Connolly, the surviving family of Father Carney, who was disappeared in Honduras in 1983, who you're just talking about, as well as Jennifer Harbury, still looking for her husband's bones in Guatemala. Sister Diana Ortiz will be there as well, who continues to demand the truth about her terrible ordeal of rape and mutilation in Guatemala. What is the latest on her case, Kate Doyle, in terms of what she has found out from the U.S. government? She went on a hunger fast outside the White House. In fact, Hillary Clinton went over to say hello to her. But what has she learned?
Deanna Ortiz has received some documents from the Clinton administration. State Department, CIA, and DOD have all released documents. Sadly, most of the material that has been released to Sister Ortiz has been butchered. It is almost illegible. There are huge critical portions of it that have been withheld from her, and thus she's still unable to understand what the United States government has in its files on her case, which is truly tragic.
Sister Diana was one of the only cases in the Intelligence Oversight Board's report that was not explored fully. In fact, the Intelligence Oversight Board, which was set up by the White House to review U.S. operations in Guatemala and human rights violations against a few U.S. citizens and a Guatemalan, refused to comment on her case, saying that the Department of Justice was investigating. Our understanding is that this Department of Justice investigation was extremely bruising to Sister Diana. They appear to have spent most of their time questioning her credibility as opposed to trying to find the perpetrators. And when they finally concluded it, what did they do? They kept the information, the most insulting act of the administration against Sister Diana. They finished the review, and then they classify it. They make it secret. How more symbolic can it get? The administration's reluctance. Their words were flowery. They were full of encouragement. The First Lady met with her and said they would do everything they could to get her, allow her to obtain the truth. And when the administration finishes that investigation, they classify it.
Carlos Salinas and Kate Doyle, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International and Kate Doyle with the National Security Archives, both based in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Burmese democracy activists have long charged that the military regime in Burma has been deeply involved in the illegal trafficking of heroin. Now, a new report in The Nation magazine this week not only examines official Burmese government corruption, but ties U.S. investment banks to the dirty business of laundering drug money. The conduit is Singapore, where top government officials are engaged in joint business ventures with one of the world's most notorious drug traffickers and with the drug-backed military dictatorship of Burma. The authors of the piece in The Nation magazine called Singapore's Blood Money are Leslie Keen, co-author with Alan Clements of Burma's Revolution of the Spirit, and Dennis Bernstein, an associate editor of Pacific News Service and co-producer of Flashpoints on Pacifica KPFA radio station in Berkeley. Dennis, explain the connections.
Amy, this is an article, believe it or not, that links the fiercely anti-drug government of Singapore with the largest heroin trafficker in Burma, Lo Sing Han, in an operation of investment from Singapore to Burma that is arranged by Morgan Guaranteed Trust Company, a subsidiary of J.P. Morgan. So you have the most fierce anti-drug government in the world in business with the most notorious heroin dealer in Burma, brokered by Morgan Guaranteed Trust Company. The extraordinary thing here is that in Burma, if you get caught with less than a half ounce of heroin, you hang. And usually the people who hang are poor couriers, women with children, while drug dealers reign free and do big deals with the Singapore government.
In fact, Dennis, you begin your article in The Nation talking about Fridays being hanging days in Singapore.
Friday mornings are hanging days at Singapore. And these days it could be not just one person. They do group hangings. These are highly sophisticated, well-planned hangings in which they weigh the victim, measure the rope, and they make sure that there are no screw-ups. The people who hang are like people like Angel Moo, who 1995, she's caught with about a half ounce of heroin. There is nothing that can be done for her. She has two children. There's a major outcry from human rights organizations, from the governor of the island where she comes from, but no go. She hangs. So meanwhile, while she's hanging, Lo Sing Han, Stephen Law, key operatives dealing in drug-related activities in Burma, set up shop in Singapore for a $1.2 billion relationship between Burma and Singapore.
Before we get to Morgan Guaranteed, Leslie Keen, I wanted to ask about Burma being a major international drug trafficker, the entire government. I was really pretty shocked by the article, the quotes you have from the U.S. State Department, not to mention human rights groups, that have documented how much the Slork government is propped up by drug money.
That's correct. This economy actually depends on the drug trade, Amy. And a report that came out of the U.S. Embassy last year said that 50% of the economy is based on the illegal drug trade. And the economy is in such terrible shape right now that it's clear, and as you say, it's clear to governments around the world and to human rights organizations that this is a major, major problem in Burma.
How does that work? What does it mean to say it's based on the drug trade? They grow poppies, and then what?
Well, the exports, I mean, there's a lot of money that is paid up the line to the highest officials of the SLORC. There are bribes that are paid out in the field where the poppies are actually grown. And, you know, there are companies like Asia World, which is the company we're talking about here, which could very likely be a front for the exports of drugs. We don't know that for sure, but there are so many companies where money is laundered, and there are so many people involved in these activities that the money manages to find its way up into the economy through various levels of operations.
And there is, in fact, as we break in our story, an ongoing international narcotics investigation of the operations of Stephen Law, Lo Sing Han, and Asia World. Understand what an amazing marriage of convenience that this could be. Asia World now controls a deep water port, a bus company, and a toll road from Burma's poppy-growing area to the Chinese border. If you've got Asia World running this operation and it's protected by the Burmese military, what more could a drug trafficker want?
Can you explain what Asia World is and just who Lo Sing Han and his son Stephen Law are?
Okay, Asia World is Burma's biggest conglomerate. It's the biggest company in Burma. It started in 1994, and it's managed to just explode in the last few years. And that's one reason why nobody knows where all the money comes from that has gone into this company. They started off as a small agricultural company, and they're now in infrastructure, manufacturing, trading, real estate, building hotels all over Burma, building roads, ports. It's an unbelievable explosion, and they really dominate the business scene in Burma. Lo Sing Han is the chairman of this company. And as we mentioned earlier, Lo Sing Han is one of Burma's biggest drug dealers. He founded the company, and his son, Stephen Law, is the managing director of the company. So the two of them control this operation.
So you have this company, Asia World, not clear where it gets all its money. Where do you go from there?
Well, we have to look at Singapore's relationship to Asia World. That's what's interesting here. Singapore, there was an investment entity started called the Myanmar Fund, which was really a vehicle for people to make money off of Burma. A lot of shareholders in this fund, one of them is the Singapore government. And their shares in the Myanmar Fund are managed by Morgan Guarantee Trust Company, which is a subsidiary of J.P. Morgan. Another major shareholder in the Myanmar Fund is a second subsidiary of J.P. Morgan called the Morgan Guarantee Trust Bank. Now, that bank, Morgan Guarantee, in combination with the Singapore government, own more than half of this Myanmar Fund. This Myanmar Fund owns 25% of a subsidiary of Asia World. So this is a company owned and managed by Stephen Law, in which the Singapore government's fund, the Myanmar Fund, has a 25% share in. The Myanmar Fund has also invested in a number of luxury hotels in which Asia World is also a partner. And they have a new project going on right now under construction called Sinmar Dev, which is this big real estate offices, shopping mall type of operation in Rangoon. They're also invested in that.
What does the Morgan Guarantee say about what the purpose of the Myanmar Fund is and ultimately your charges, because these are very serious charges, that this bank, this U.S. bank, is involved with international drug traffickers?
In terms of what the Myanmar Fund is, Amy, I mean, that's well established. It's in all their documents and it's in their purpose that they are a vehicle for investments in Burma. I mean, nobody's disputing that. The issue with Morgan Guarantee Trust is we have tried to speak with them many times about the issue. They basically will not talk to us. I mean, they will talk to us, but they will beat around the bush. They will not even acknowledge that they are or aren't involved with the Myanmar Fund. They're very, you know, they just don't answer your questions, and they kind of say, finally, the one interview we did, the end of the thing, he just said, I think I'll have no comment on this. So you really can't get a straight answer from Morgan Guarantee, and we hope that this article may force them to respond.
We did call up Stephen Law, who is at the heart of this article with Lo Sing Han, the son of Lo Sing Han, to ask him, in fact, if he was involved in drug trafficking or money laundering, and what happened was his first response was silence. Then he laughed, and then he said, of course not. We wouldn't be involved in that. That's illegal, and drug trafficking is illegal in we follow the laws of the government of Burma. And so we're thinking, hey, perfect. If there's a narco dictatorship, the laws probably include the support of drug trafficking. But he did deny it. The Singapore government says that this is open and above board. There's nothing to hide. These are very clean investments. Meanwhile, I'm not sure how clean they are, but to find out what's going on is literally a state secret. The GIC investments in my unmarked fund are a state secret, despite the fact that they're investing
GIC
public.
Means?
The GIC is the Government Investment Corporation of Singapore. That's what controls the Myanmar Fund and the investments in Burma. Those investments are a state secret.
And the other interesting thing, Amy, is the manager, the GIC representative on the Myanmar Fund, was actually just sentenced to 9 years in jail for accepting bribes in a scheme with the Rockefeller Company out of Hong Kong. Huh. So that shows how straight and above board the GIC is.
This is a very complicated web that goes from Burma to Singapore to right here in the United States. And so for people to really follow the web and what are all the, or to mix metaphors, the spokes of this wheel, Lo Sing-hao and his son Stephen Law, how do you know that they're involved with international drug trafficking? And are you charging that they both are?
Well, Lo Sing-hao, the father, has been involved since the 70s. It's in many DEA documents. The police in Thailand have put out documents about it. I mean, it's been for so long. He's been interviewed about it. He was out in the wilds of Burma along with Khun Sa, the other famous Burmese drug trafficker, and he was also in jail for 8 years. So he's been around for so long, it's really an established fact. You can talk to any DEA person or policeman in Thailand or anybody, and they'll tell you that it's a fact that Lo Sing-hao is a world-renowned trafficker.
And according to a document from the Thai government, which is another extraordinary connection, it shows, this document says that Lo has been in essentially working with Lieutenant General Khin Yat. He's a key player in SLARC. By the way, he just returned from a major trade visit to Singapore. According to this document, Mr. Khin Yat has agreed, and I'm quoting now, he's given the privilege to Lo Sing-hao to smuggle heroin from Kokang Group in Taichung. This is at the poppy-growing region over the border into Thailand. So the Thai government knows that a key player in the SLARC, just returning from Singapore, was in business with Lo Sing-hao.
And to finish your question, Amy, about Stephen Law, Lo Sing-hao's son, it has not been documented that he is actually a drug trafficker. He is simply highly suspected to be a drug trafficker by the agents, and in fact so much so that he's been denied a visa into the United States because of the suspicion of the United States government of his role in drug trafficking.
And what is that based on?
Well, we haven't been able to find out the specific because it's not information that they can disclose. But the number of agents have told us we are suspicious. We have reason to believe that he is involved in drug trafficking. They will not say anything beyond that.
Lo Sing-hao's newest big company is a huge container operation unmarked in Burma. They provide containers and shipping of those containers around the world. And many people are very interested to know what's being put in those containers and where they are destined. Some of those containers are destined for Malaysia, Thailand, China, and some of those containers are headed for the United States.
And Singapore.
Again, we're talking to Dennis Bernstein and Leslie Kane. They're co-authoring a piece in the current issue of The Nation magazine called Singapore's Blood Money that connects Singapore to Burma in terms of drugs and drug money and connects them right here to the United States in the form of Morgan Guarantee. Is this information being talked about in Singapore, as you said, the most fierce anti-drug nation in the world that has a number of hangings every week of low-level drug dealers? How is it playing out in Singapore politics?
Well, this specific information, actually, the government of Singapore was forced to confront some of this information in October of 96 when Australian television produced a documentary about this very issue. And so there was a bit of an outcry in Singapore for a couple months. They put out a press release acknowledging their role in the Myanmar Fund. They were asked by high-level opposition figures in Singapore about the fact that Lo Sing-hao is a drug dealer. some of the hardcore issues like that, they actually never responded to. They managed to avoid response. So, and after that, I'd say a month after this documentary was played out in Australia, of course, it was never allowed to go into Singapore, the whole issue has faded. And so this is, we're now bringing it up to the fore in a much more powerful way than it was a year ago. But in the last year, they haven't dealt with it. They have not responded to this.
Amy, what is interesting here, by the way, the Singapore government denies this. They say it's far-fetched. It's ridiculous to think that the Singapore government is in the drug business. But we interviewed the former Solicitor General of Singapore, who now is in the United States, Francis Siow. Francis Siow was a close associate of Lee Kuan Yew and was very familiar with the runnings of the government at the highest levels in Singapore. And he said, like the hangings, like they measure the rope, like they weigh the people, they know every aspect of every little thing that happens in Singapore. And for them to not understand that they're involved with drug traffickers, that's what's really far-fetched. And he calls all the money that comes through these investments from Burma into Singapore as blood money, and that's where we get the title of this article.
I mean, it's quite clear. You quote, for example, Robert Gilbard, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, saying since 1988, over half the investments from Singapore have been tied to the family of narco-trafficker Ho Seng Han. Most of these investments, you say, are in joint projects with Lo's family-controlled Asia World company. I mean, what is Singapore saying if this company is controlled by Lo Seng Han and his son?
Well, what's really being said here, Amy, and I think what's quite important, is that they're not interested in the relationship between major business, so-called legitimate business, and the huge below-board global drug trade. This story is where those two meet, and it shows Singapore now being considered the investment capital of the world and being pushed by the Wall Street Journal as the place to invest, says this: we don't care about the drug economy. We don't care about that relationship between so-called legitimate business and the major global heroin trade. As long as it works, there's a fair amount of return on your investment, it's irrelevant where the money comes from or who you're dealing with. That's what this is all about.
You also quote Dr. Chee Soon Juan, the Secretary General of the Singapore Democratic Party. What's he saying?
Well, he's very concerned about the hypocrisy because he lives in Singapore and he's very aware of these hangings that go on, the stories about these small-time, you know, single mothers who have had heroin planted in their suitcases. They don't even know it's there, and then they're hanged. And he's very concerned about the hypocrisy between that and the fact that the Singapore government, and not just the Singapore government, we're talking about, you know, companies in Singapore as well, are investing with these drug dealers in Burma. He has asked the government of Singapore to respond to this. And he was the most vocal person. He's been the most vocal person so far in the country in forcing them to respond, and they've managed to avoid it so far.
According to the former Singapore Solicitor General, now in the United States, and this is a quote from him, this is how he looks at it: the Singapore government now is having dinner with the devil and sharing a very short spoon. It is a terrible double standard. Drug monies are being laundered apparently by the same drug lords who supply the heroin for which small-time drug dealers are hanged. We are reaping the profits as Burma's biggest investor, but we are being paid with blood money. This is the story in a nutshell. If you're Lo Seng Han, if you're one of the most notorious heroin dealers in the world, but you have a front company that appears legitimate, we'll invest with you. If you're a low-level courier, if you're poverty-stricken, if you're stuck, or if you don't even know you're carrying drugs into the country and they could be Lo Seng Han's drugs, we're going to hang you on the spot.
What does this mean for Morgan Guarantee if this information is accurate? Aren't there laws in this country that you can't do business with drug dealers?
Well, I can tell you, Amy, that they were a bit nervous as we called and asked them to respond to this charge. They are obviously not supposed to be becoming a front, a big shield for money launderers in Burma.
I would guess that the nation lawyers were pretty busy this week as your article came out.
They definitely were. It's funny that you said that. They held up the article maybe a day or two, what but the lawyers, but we managed to get through because every single fact in this article can be backed up.
Singapore is known as the as the suing capital of the world. In Singapore proper, there will be very few candidates to take on the ruling party because they know if they open their mouths and they are their nuance is off slightly, they will be sued to the point where they will either end up in debtor's prison or be poverty-stricken and working to make the money back to deal with the lawsuit. You don't take on the Singapore government. They sue everybody all the time, and people are terrified. So you can bet that the nation lawyers were really concerned about what we're doing here. But as Leslie said, this is all documented. It's based on various stock exchanges from different countries. It's based on narcotics documents. It's based on interviews with various agents. It's based on company documents from Singapore and from Burma. We would not be allowed to go forward with an article that links Singapore with the Burmese government brokered by Morgan Trust unless we had our ducks in line, as they say.
Well, it goes further than just linking them to the Burmese government, because that they admit. It's linking them to the Burmese government, which is more than half funded by drug trafficking.
And, of course, it's way more than that because it's got the Morgan Guaranteed Trust, a subsidiary of J.P. Morgan, perhaps the number one bank in America in terms of Wall Street, as an investor in Burma, in the Myanmar Fund with Loh Sing Han. So it's not only that they're a custodial agent of Singapore, they themselves apparently are controlling major investments in Burma.
Leslie Kane, you wrote Burma's Revolution of the Spirit. What is happening right now in Burma in terms of the crackdown on Aung San Suu Kyi and her supporters?
Well, it's actually gradually getting worse, I hate to say. I mean, it's more and more severe, and a lot of it right now is because the economy, the economy in Burma is really going down the tubes, and I think that Aung San Suu Kyi has said that she thinks this is really going to be the issue that's going to turn things around, that people are going to become intolerant when they can no longer afford to buy food. And so we're watching very closely. It seems to be moving more and more in that direction in Burma, where something is probably going to happen, as she has indicated. She expects something to happen before the end of this year, whether it be demonstrations again or what, we don't know. But the SLORC certainly still has an iron grip on the country, and they will stop with nothing in terms of repressing any kind of a movement. So we'll see what happens.
Thank you very much. Dennis Bernstein, Leslie Kane, authors of the piece in the Current Nation magazine, Singapore's Blood Money. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court yesterday denied an appeal by a conservative nonprofit citizens group seeking access to President Clinton's videotaped testimony at the trial of his Whitewater business partners. Citizens United had requested the unedited videotape of Clinton's testimony last year in the trial, in which his two former business partners, James and Susan McDougal, and his successor as governor of Arkansas, Jim Guy Tucker, were convicted of conspiracy and fraud. Still, the small-time Ozark Mountain real estate deal, which has dogged Bill Clinton throughout his presidency, remains a mystery to many Americans. And we still await the final verdict of the independent counsel, Kenneth Starr. Will there be indictments at the highest levels of the U.S. government? Tonight, PBS's Frontline examines the series of deals, relationships, and alleged cover-ups that have come to be known as Whitewater in a documentary called Once Upon a Time in Arkansas.
Once upon a time in Arkansas, a local Wheeler dealer had a vision, and he decided to chase it. He would involve his political friends. He'd require some artful legal maneuvering involving the state's most notable lawyer. This compelling idea centered on a spread of land outside of Little Rock. Hundreds of working-class families would get a chance to own their own homes, and our dreamer and his political friends could make some money. The project was called Castle Grande. But the dream went badly wrong, and this circle of friends, some of Arkansas's best and brightest, would find themselves ensnared by scandal. Four have gone to prison. One is dead by his own hand. And two live in the White House.
And that's the beginning of Once Upon a Time in Arkansas, to be heard on PBS's Frontline tonight. The correspondent, Peter Boyer, who journeys to the president's home state to reveal what really lays at the heart of the alleged wrongdoing. And he joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter.
Hey, Amy. Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's very interesting to be with you on this day after the Supreme Court ruled that President Clinton's videotaped testimony in the Whitewater case does not have to be made public. Did that surprise you?
A little bit, yes. It did, because I don't know the interior of the legal arguments on both sides. I know a little bit about it, but you know, had you been in that courtroom, it was a public proceeding. You would have seen that, and the transcripts are out. The argument had been that the release of the videotape might play into the hands of Republicans in a partisan way in the context of the 96 election, but as of course. That's over.
That's so, right, that they could use it in a commercial.
That's right, which of course would have been an interesting new turn in our politics. But I'm a little bit puzzled by it, yeah.
Well, why don't we talk a little about Whitewater? Some people might be rolling their eyes right now. Oh, my God, the story I never understand. And they're going to talk about again. But in fact, the case is still not resolved. Kenneth Starr, the independent counsel, continues to investigate. Susan McDougall has been in prison for more than a year. But lay the groundwork, and then we're going to play also some of the clips as you talk that are in the documentary of Jim McDougall and Susan McDougall from prison.
Yes, ma'am. Well, that sort of eye-rolling phenomenon is precisely what prompted us to back to Arkansas. I've been reporting down there most of these last several years on various aspects of the Clinton past, and we've come to this weird place in our culture where stories kind of appear and then go away when the next spectacular trial of, you know, some celebrity or whatnot occurs, and then that kind of nothing ever sort of seems to end. But in fact, as you just noted, Amy, there's some very grave questions being considered by a federal prosecutor who at this moment is weighing indictments. They draw from these long ago land dealings. But what they've particularly come to focus on is this long train of obfuscation and concealment on the part of the Clintons and folks around them, commencing in 1992 during his first presidential campaign and leading up until, you know, just recent months. That may indeed result in indictments on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice.
Lay out the web briefly, starting with Castle Grande.
Certainly. It can't be simply put, but I'll try. There was a fellow called Jim McDougall, who, of course, is infamous now and sitting in prison where we interviewed him in Kentucky, who was a political creature to his soul. But who grew up in the post-depression South, Bible Belt, Arkansas, and wanted to make some dough, and was innovative and brilliant and perfectly suited to the game he chose, which was the savings and loan gig during the deregulated 80s, when you could basically do anything you wanted. It was literally limited only by the imagination and daring of the operator, as we say in the broadcast, And he had quite an imagination. And he also had this populist political strain, and he had this great idea. He was going to buy this big parcel of land, this huge hunk of land south of Little Rock, divide it up into affordable parcels of land, finance it. Folks could come in there and put a double-wide trailer on it and get a piece of the American dream, and he could make some money. But not just him. His avocation, as he puts it, to us. His version of playing golf was to hang out with politicians, to collect politicians, to bring his political pals into his deals. He loved the association, and so he did. This fellow and that group with this mindset undertook this deal at Castle Grande, and the problem was the law doesn't allow it. A savings and loan can't just go in and completely finance a big development project like this. So he had to contrive a way around the law. And the way he did that was to construct a series of what regulators came to recognize finally as being sham deals, straw men. The principal straw man was a fellow called Seth Ward, who happens to be the father-in-law to Webb Hubble. They created basically this circle of money, a series of deals that had the effect of allowing Jim McDougal to go in and do what he wanted to do, buy up all this land, while making it seem that others were doing it. In fact, others were doing it with money he had lent them, and which they repaid him in this circular series of complex deals, which at one point there was a legal mechanism designed to obscure this series of circular sham deals, an option agreement to Seth Ward to make it to further obscure it from the eyes of regulators, that was drawn up by McDougal's friend and business partner and lawyer, Hillary Clinton. And that has become key to so much. That document, that instrument, that act of lawyering has become key to so much of what followed. The fact that she did that was, at the very least, a few years later, a potential political embarrassment, which led to this long train of obfuscations and concealments, which right now are being considered by a new grand jury just convened a couple of weeks ago down in Washington.
Now, Jim McDougal did go to trial a first time, where he was acquitted to his surprise.
Yes, ma'am, and that's part of the sort of the human narrative of this story. It's very interesting yarn, that part of it, to me anyway, of these folks who were friends. And of course, Arkansas is now, perhaps to the point of cliche, but it's at its heart true, known to be a tightly insular place where folks really did run into each other every day, and people really did, you know, they were in one another's britches all the time, so to speak. And McDougal and the Clintons were perhaps not the closest of friends as the Clintons were with other people, but they were deeply involved with one another. When McDougal hit rock bottom in the middle 80s, lost his business, lost his marriage, was put on trial, had a physical breakdown, a mental breakdown, and then prevailed at his trial and was acquitted. He counted on Bill Clinton, his friend in high places, to help him out, to somehow help him in his sort of process to redemption. And Clinton promised McDougal's aged mother that he would. And they sat there waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And when the fault call finally came from his friend Bill Clinton, it was, McDougal tells us, to ask for money.
Well, let's hear what Jim McDougal says in your documentary that'll air on Frontline tonight, Peter Boyer, Once Upon a Time in Arkansas.
The real purpose of the call was to get some money in connection with Whitewater.
President Clinton did
obviously
call.
Obviously, Hillary was on the extension prompting him. It was very, very awkward for him. Although I became quite angry about the contents of the conversation, I felt sorry for him because it was so belittling. But he called up to ask me for $3,000.
That was Jim McDougal in that interview you did with him from prison. And it seems that that is the point where Jim McDougal really turned and went after Bill Clinton by going to a Republican enemy of Clinton's in Arkansas, right, and telling the story and talking to Jeff Gerth of the New York Times, who first broke the story.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, of the options that occurred to Jim McDougal back there in Arkansas back then, the one he chose was to go see this fellow called Sheffield Nelson, a lawyer, prominent lawyer, fellow who, in fact, had run against Bill Clinton for governor and lost. And in speaking with Mr. Nelson, McDougal said, I can sink it faster than they can lie about it, speaking of the Clintons and Whitewater. And Nelson recorded that conversation, and he said to him, McDougal, there's a fella here interested in some of these things. Would you talk to him? And that fella happened to be Jeff Gerth. This is 1992. Jeff Gerth, reporter for the New York Times, who wrote the early Whitewater stories and opened up this can of worms that is still with us today.
And meanwhile, Peter Boyer, Susan McDougal remains in prison for more than a year, and you got a chance to talk to her there, although she wasn't very forthcoming with answers. Let's take a listen.
To your knowledge, did the president testify truthfully at your trial?
I won't answer any questions that might help the independent counsel in his investigation.
To your knowledge, how much did Bill Clinton know about that $300,000 loan that...
I'll tell you, we can't go into this. This is something we talked about before.
I don't know of any relationship with this $300,000 loan
with Whitewater to any question that Kenneth Starr would likely ask her before the Whitewater grand jury. If you want to get into personal details, there's exactly the same question.
Just not waste any more time.
I've been in jail for a year about this. A year. This is why I came to jail. Because I won't have anything to do with questions that have to do with the investigation. I just won't.
Did you have a relationship with Bill Clinton?
No.
When he was governor?
No.
Peter Boyer, why is Susan McDougal still in jail?
Well, because she is, in refusing to testify before a grand jury, in contempt. And, of course, there is much... political debate about the fact that Ken Starr, the independent counsel, keeps her there, Ken Starr and the federal judge down in Arkansas, on whose order she remains incarcerated. But I guess the real question is, why won't she answer those questions straightforwardly and just tell the truth, whatever it is? And her answer is, well, because they're not interested in the truth, they want me to tell lies about Bill Clinton. There is another possible explanation, shall we say, suggests itself, and that is that Susan McDougal has gotten herself into some real trouble of the sort that spending time on contempt charges is only the beginning. She stands convicted of a federal crime in Arkansas related to Castle Grande, the Whitewater stuff. And when this particular jail sentence is finished, and when that jail sentence is finished, she still faces embezzlement charges on something completely different out in California. As you know, the Zubin Mehta and Mrs. Mehta embezzlement situation. And
the orchestra conductor and his wife.
Yes, ma'am. And what she has done and what she is doing, and one feels some sympathy for her, I have to confess, but... I'm not sure this is going to be a fruitful posture, is to pose the prospect that she, Susan McDougal, has seen this prosecution of Whitewater as being political from the beginning, and therefore, as an act of protest, she didn't put up any defense in the first trial. That explains that conviction, and that she is only in jail on this thing because of that, and that the Zubin Mehta charges are also political.
Peter Boyer, we do have to go right now, but in a one-word answer, do you think that Hillary Clinton will be indicted?
I think that they could indict her. They have the stuff. Whether they will is a question Ken Starr will answer.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Peter Boyer, frontline correspondent. The program, Once Upon a Time in Arkansas, will air tonight on PBS. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland and Andy York are engineers. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.